Welcome to Changemaker with founder of Gypsy Tea and social entrepreneur Zina Muzika.
This new podcast is to help you embrace change and experience amazing people and entrepreneurs. We're going to be sharing secrets, habits, and change-making abilities with you so that you can apply them to your life and make a life of your dreams.
This is Changemaker with Zina Muzika.
Hi, and welcome to Changemaker. Today, we are interviewing Shiza Shahid. Am I saying that right?
Yes.
Awesome. She is a Pakistani social entrepreneur and activist who previously served as a business analyst at McKinsey & Company. By the way, she's 25. I mean, now. And she's previously served as a business analyst. I mean, come on. She was recently named one of Time Magazine's 30 Under 30 World Changers and Forbes 30 Under 30 list of social entrepreneurs. And her last project was one of great interest. She helped co-found the Malala Fund. So welcome to Changemaker.
Thank you for having me.
You're like the poster girl for a changemaker.
So excited to be here.
Thank you. So, Shiza, you were a student in Pakistan, and you helped, you started volunteering early on. Tell us a little bit about your early days as a social activist.
Yeah, I was growing up in Pakistan at a time when there was a lot happening that was troubling. There were rising suicide attacks, terrorist attacks. It was already a country where there was severe poverty, imbalance of wealth, women's rights were dwindling, and there was a growing mindset of religious radicalism and extremism. And I had the privilege of having a family that treated daughters and sons equally, and my father and my mother prioritized our education beyond anything else. But I knew that all around me things were different and getting worse. And that was very confusing. And so at an early age, I began trying to understand what was happening around me and how I could stop my society's social fabric from decaying. And I began volunteering in really any place that I thought I could be helpful. So when I was 13 or 14, I was volunteering in women's prisons. And in those prisons were women who had been accused of a crime, but also little children. These were children who had been born to their mothers in prison and effectively stayed there because there was nowhere else for them to go. So you had little children growing up there. And I realized what it must be like to be discarded before you were even born, to have no one outside waiting for you. When I was 16, I spent about a year volunteering in an earthquake relief camp. There was a massive earthquake in Pakistan, and one of my closest friends died. And so I dealt with the grief of that by volunteering in a relief camp for victims. And I was the only regular female volunteer, which meant that any issue regarding women and girls was given to me, even though I was very young. So I would sit in hot tents with little girls, chatting away all day, knowing that we couldn't go outside because their fathers and their brothers didn't want them to be seen. And I realized there what it felt like to be a woman whose very existence was a source of shame. So these were the experiences that I began to have in my adolescence that really shaped the way that I saw the world and the way that I saw my own purpose here. And then eventually led me to get a scholarship to Stanford and continue to start programs in the impact space.
Great. So let me ask you, I mean, you're now in New York and you're a very active social entrepreneur and you're all over the press and you're very liberated and beautiful and glowing and the embodiment of an empowered woman, really. So when you go back, How does that chasm between being empowered and being around so many disempowered women, how do you bridge that and connect with them?
There's a lot of empowered women in Pakistan, in the Middle East. I think very often we don't see it because here in the West, being empowered means not having your head covered or going out dancing at a club and having the freedom to do that. And those are things that are considered impious in many parts of the world. But that doesn't mean that the women who live with those choices or those values are not empowered. And in Pakistan, I've seen some of the bravest, strongest, most determined women who overcome great obstacles. My own mother, you know, she married my father and met him on their wedding day. And many would say, well, that's such an unempowered choice. And yet, you know, thanks to fate, they were an incredible couple. And she made sure that no matter how low we were on money, my father put us in the absolute best private schools and that we never compromised on that. And that was her decision. And so looking at what empowerment really means across cultures is something that's badly needed, I think. And women across the world have to reach out across obvious divides and beyond stereotypes and prejudices and really say, well, what are the incredible things that these women are doing that maybe I don't recognize because my cultural understanding of empowered is limited?
Yeah, so let's talk about that. I mean, I went to an all-women's college that was international, and we had to take a vow to protect other women. And to me, that was empowerment. The fact that I was going to be an advocate and stand up for women's rights and always, you know, ask for equality, for me, that was just the very simple. But then traveling to India and Sri Lanka, and I've been to Pakistan, to Lahore, and I've never thought that covering the head was disempowered. I think what it is the almost the expectations of women in a lot of parts of the world are that if they have a dream, they almost, like, they don't have as many opportunities. They're not as empowered to achieve it. So maybe, I mean, what's your definition of an empowered woman?
Absolutely. The opportunities that women have in places like Pakistan are very limited. It is very hard to get a good education. It's very hard to then work, to be able to choose when and if you have children, when and if you get married, to live independently on your own. Even just the security risks that come with that in many parts of the country are immense. So there's a lot that women have to overcome. And I think there is a onus on society, on governments, on businesses, on those with power to step up and to change that. And an onus on women to come together if they have the opportunity to do that. Because again, the obstacles that women face are so harsh that very often I take objection to the idea that, well, women have to change all of this for themselves, because you're talking about often risking violence and
Absolutely.
Abuse. On the other hand, I think the other thing that I do take objection to is this idea that women are docile or dormant in these societies, right? And are not facing immense pressure and over displaying immense strength, even doing just basic things. So I think that universality of strength that women are displaying, mm-hmm. and how much more strength they're actually displaying in places where they're seen as passive mm-hmm. or unempowered, but the society at large needs to give them the opportunity to rise.
Agreed. When I was running the tea company, I found that women only make $1.35 a day in the tea fields. And I went out to see it. And I went to India first, all over, and then I went to Sri Lanka. And I found that the infant mortality rates were also very, very high. And they had an average of 6 to 8 people, depending on them, in the tea fields on $1.35 a day. And as soon as we started giving them fair trade money, they started building cottage industries, making clothes, opening up, you know, weekend shops. They all had savings plans. They built schools. I mean, it was a beautiful thing to see something where, you know, they were living in abject poverty, and what they did the minute they had a few extra, you know, resources at their disposal, it was like the whole world opened up, and the men followed suit. The men loved. I mean, I believe from seeing that as soon as women take the lead, men do follow. It's just in certain parts of the world, the men are bearing arms.
Right. And we all know the statistics, right? 90% of every dollar that a woman earns, she invests back into her community. 30 to 40% is the statistic for men. So really creating the opportunities to allow women to thrive is the quickest way that we can lift millions
Absolutely.
Out of poverty.
Absolutely.
My favorite example probably of this, you know, perception of strength versus the reality of it is Malala's mother. And, you know, she's someone who covers her face, who doesn't like being out in public. And that's her piety, her humility. That's the culture that she comes from. And there's been many journalists who've written, well, Malala's mother is not empowered, but she is really the bedrock of strength in that family. She's the reason that Malala can go out and do what she does and come home and feel safe and feel loved. And it's the same for her father. And that is one of the most empowering things that she can be doing for her family and for herself and for the world at large. And so what we see versus what it really is so
different. I disagree with the idea that if a woman wants to cover her face, or I disagree that that's disempowered, because I think that in the West, I mean, women are, as we age, they're like, we're using surgeries, we're doing this. I mean, we spend so much time on our appearance. I think it's liberating. If I didn't have to worry about, you know, getting my grays covered, or, I mean, I guess I don't have to, but I'm vain because I am exposed. I really do, I think about it a lot, because when I go to Sri Lanka, there are a lot of women in full cover just showing their eyes, and to me, it looks a bit liberating. I would like to have a choice to go there or not. And then, yeah, I think the perception of empowerment is really the question at hand. And I think if we're suppressed and unable to express ourselves, then it's a disempowering situation. But I think if we have a choice to express ourselves in however way, then that is empowered.
And I think a lot of people look at American society and say, oh my God, the women here are so disempowered. They're so sexualized. You walk around New York and you see these plastered billboards of women in bathing suits, women in hypersexualized advertisements. And I think they look at that and they see something that's even more disenfranchising than the burqa. And,
agreed.
You know, that's debatable, but there's definitely something there.
I agree. So, Shiza, you, when I saw you last, we were at Bloomberg Next, and I said, oh my God, Malala won the, you know, Nobel Peace Prize. And you said, and I said, what's going to happen? You said, well, she's going to finish school.
Right.
I love your practicality. Right. And is there any, what have you learned in building the Malala Fund? I mean, a girl who has a voice was shot in the head by men who would silence that voice. You rose to the occasion and brought a, you know, you put it out in the world in a big way, so it could have an impact. What did you learn from that experience?
You know, I knew Malala since she was 11, and she was like my little sister, and I was very close to her and her father and her mother and to that family. And her shooting was one of the most traumatizing things that I've ever been through, and her survival is the greatest miracle that I will ever witness in my life. The way that she survived, the strength with which she came back, not just physically but emotionally, she is 110% the girl that she always was. And this immense privilege that she's been given now with this microphone to amplify the voices of girls who are persecuted, to tell that story in a way that resonates so that people listen. I mean, we had known that girls were persecuted for decades, but Malala's story and her voice really made that real. And for me, when I first came into this situation, when I first flew in to see her, I went in with a protective instinct, and it was, I want to be there to help her recover. I want to be there to make sure she's protected, that if she chooses to tell her story, she gets to tell it in the way that she wants, at the pace that she chooses. And if she chooses to speak again, it's words that she has had the time and opportunity to think through. And whatever choices she makes, she has the ability to execute upon them. And that's what I went in with. And as she woke up and recovered and said, I want to speak, I want to be out there, I want to make a difference, that's when I saw the opportunity to create something larger and to help shift what was then the story of a victim in the way that it was being told, the story of a leader, the story of a voice, of an entrepreneur, of an advocate. And it's been phenomenal to see that transformation, the number of girls and boys and adults that she's inspired, the number of people who are now aware of what children are suffering, what girls are suffering, the attention that's come to this issue, and of course the Nobel Peace Prize that focused on her and her fellow Nobel Prize winner Kailash Satyarthi, who has also been a hero working on the rights of children. And that's been a really, really gratifying journey.
Wonderful. I played her Nobel Peace Prize speech to my 15-year-old son and my 4-year-old daughter, and they were both, I mean, Mia doesn't sit down for much, and they were both just glued to it. And she does bear a very powerful voice for young people, and she's a wake-up call for grown-ups. Yeah.
I was at an event the other day. I was speaking at a conference, and they had a video of young girls stating their dreams, and this one 13-year-old says on the video, she says, "Well, I'm going to be the CEO of Nike, and I'm going to win the Nobel Prize for Physics." And I thought, wow, I wonder if this girl would have thought of winning the Nobel Prize before Malala did. But now that's achievable.
Yeah, it's within grasp.
Right.
Yeah, I think that the 21st century, and my next book I'm working on is a spiritual handbook for women at work. It's an entrepreneurial guide, but it's all based in spirit. And it's I believe that the 21st century, the more we step into power, and balance out the masculine that's been a little rampant for a long time.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
You're listening to Changemaker with Zena Muzica.
The Mayans believed that there were 5,000 years of male dominance on the planet and then 5,000 years of female, and it goes back and forth is their belief system. And in 1984, it shifted to the female.
Really?
And if you think about how far we've come since 1984, I mean, it still feels like molasses in a lot of parts of the world, but we have come very far with these, you know, bringing our voices out and letting them be heard, and with the internet and with everything. I think we are definitely in the power century for women.
I think we're starting to realize how insane some of our ideas about gender have been, right? And And we grew up with them, too. We grew up with ideas of gender that come from nothing, come from culture, come from decades of economics and politics. And we're starting to realize how much we've missed.
Yeah.
And to your point of, you know, when I go back home and I see women who don't have opportunities, you feel this deep sense of anger and frustration, because some of us are beginning to realize it, but these are such deeply entrenched values, beliefs, systems, that you know how many more women are going to continue to fall victim to that cycle, both what society is imposing and what they have internalized.
Have you, I keynoted a couple years ago at the U.S. Institute of Peace for Economic Empowerment of Women. And they have a program where they go into war-torn areas and they give entrepreneurial courses and mentorship to entrepreneurs. And one woman from Afghanistan had a driving school for women. And she said she gets death threats every day, but she still teaches women to drive. And I was amazed at this rising of entrepreneurial spirit, because I believe business has more power than governments to actually affect change in the world. So tell me a little bit about your entrepreneurial future, what you're working on, and how you see that in the world.
Absolutely. And, you know, women in places like Afghanistan are taking immense risks. But then you look at places like the U.S. and you realize, as of today, only 3% of venture capital goes to women CEOs. When you talk about venture capital, this is the type of investment that's given.
Is it up to 3%?
2.7, I'm rounding.
Because I raised $8.5 million. And I have to say, I was the only woman in almost 99.9% of the rooms, and it was both a challenge and it was also invigorating, because I thought, I am breaking this glass ceiling. I am like, oh my God, are you kidding me? Like, I'm going to force this wall down for all the women to follow me. Like, you cannot take this from, you know, I couldn't believe it. But I also found that there is, I thought it was 0.03%. But if it's up to 3%, at least it's going in the right direction.
Yes, it's up to 3%. And you have war stories, clearly. But, you know, these are the businesses. These are the Facebooks, Googles. These are fast-growing businesses. These are the businesses that are going to dominate our economy. So this is the area where we should be seeing the highest number of women-led businesses, because this can really shift the balance. In technology and even beyond, because these are businesses that can really employ a lot of people very quickly, grow very quickly, IPO quickly. These are high growth potential businesses. So if you talk about shifting the power balance, and also these are innovative companies. So, and they're invested in by people who believe in innovation and change. And so to see the numbers be so low is rather terrifying.
And considering 50% of startups in the US, over 50% are women now.
Exactly.
And they're not getting funded.
Exactly.
And I've been a volunteer for a long time on Women's Economic Ventures, and we're a nonprofit in Santa Barbara County, and we have an 85% success rate of getting women out of poverty and into their own business within 18 months. All they need is the education. So we put them through a 14-week business course, but only like 5% of them apply for the $50,000 loans after. Yet 85% succeed. I mean, talk about resourcefulness. I've always been blown away at women's ability to make things happen with little. I mean, I had $6 the day I started my business, and it was just this, and I've been trying to pinpoint what it is in a woman, but we can actually create something out of nothing. And I hope all the women listening really let that sink in, because I do believe, you know, we make babies out of a, you know, tiny, tiny, tiny molecule you can't even see with the bare eye, and we can make businesses just the same way.
Absolutely. I think women have incredible entrepreneurial capabilities. And I think entrepreneurship and innovation have to be the next frontier where women lean in,
absolutely,
drive forward, and really make their mark, because this can tilt the power balance. Even when you look at, you know, Fortune 500 companies, there are a large number of companies that don't have a single woman on their board.
Yeah.
And not to get too geeky on this show, but, you know, in the U.S. there aren't fixed-term board limits, which means once you have an all-male board, you're unlikely to even be able to rotate people off.
Yeah.
But you talk about new businesses that are getting venture capital. They're starting from scratch, and in 5 years, 10 years, they could be the next Google, the next Apple. So they have the ability to rewrite the formula. And I'm hoping that we will see a significant shift in how they're doing that.
I think it's inevitable, especially with women like you out there, you know, advocating for it. So you mentioned that you're working on a couple entrepreneurial projects. Are you at liberty to talk about those?
Somewhat. I'm really excited about being at a place now where I feel confident that Malala and the mission that I set out to help her achieve is in a very strong place. And with the Nobel Prize and with the success of the Malala Fund, I feel at liberty to really go out again and find other Malalas, other incredible women, girls, entrepreneurs, innovators that are doing incredible things in the developing world, in the developed world, and to invest in them and put capital behind them, put mentorship behind them. So I'm working on a couple of projects now to build out funds that invest in social entrepreneurs in the developing world and that invest in women across the developed world.
We definitely should compare notes. I have a lot of contacts in that space. And so, well, thank you. So tell me your secret to jumping into change with such a fearless full force. I mean, I think a lot of our listeners are looking at their lives and they have an infrastructure built and they're wondering how to shift it. And you seem to move around change with a high level of grace and maturity beyond your years. Can you talk a little bit about what your secrets are to shifting and moving with times and changes, and you know, what's your secret?
Well, my mother, who's quite religious, believes in the idea that everything happens for a reason. And I don't know if I believe in quite that version of it, but Steve Jobs had the secular version, which was you can only connect the dots looking back. And so he talked about when he was fired from Apple and he realized that he had all of these incredible things that he had to go out and do and then come back, or when he took a calligraphy class and that inspired the typeface for Apple years later. And so I really believe that we cannot control everything that's going to happen in our lives, but we can control how we react. And if we manage to do that and be positive and optimistic and look at things in the most hopeful way possible, and believe in our own strength. To your point, walking into those rooms when you were raising funding, you could have thought, my God, am I good enough? Or you could have thought, but I'm going to do this, right? Oh, yeah. I can do this. Yeah. And I think that attitude of I can do this and I have self-worth and value and I can make things happen, I can manifest things. Mm-hmm. That's what's allowed me to create things, to try things, to deal with failure, to pivot. And I think it's something that if I were to look at all of the things in my life that I'm grateful for, in addition to my family and my health, I would say the belief that I can manifest things, that I can make things happen, just that attitude of positivity and self-confidence is something that I'm most grateful for, because everything else, how smart I am or how smart I'm not, where I'm born, everything that I'm given as a talent or that I'm not given as a talent, that's not something I can control. But what I create is what I allow myself to believe.
Yeah, I was the least likely girl to become an entrepreneur, but I am like you, where I saw a cause. You know, first it was to help my son, which you've read my book. Yeah, you
it's
got
beautiful.
One of the galleys.
I did. It's a great, great story.
Thanks. But, you know, it was for my son. And then once I met the mothers, it was like I never really saw the profit. Like, I wasn't focused on profits. I was just focused on the social profits. And I believe with young leaders like you coming into the world, we'll be able to marry the business model of, you know, singular focus on profits to, you know, the people and the planet and the social responsibility, because I believe in the 21st century, that's what business must be.
Absolutely. And I think something else you touched upon right here was the openness to a shift in perspective, right? And I think we exist in a time today where we have more opportunity to shift our perspective, and we're born into a particular view of the world and particular circumstances. But the more we open our eyes, the more we explore, the more we connect with others with openness and empathy, the more we start to find our own place in the world. And for me, that was going into various communities that were underprivileged and volunteering and understanding what it means to have incredible strength in those situations. And for you, it was finding these incredible mothers doing incredible work and uplifting them and connecting them and amplifying them. Yeah.
Well, they threw my wedding, and I haven't been back in a year, so I'm scheduling a trip. But it does feel like we're knitting together a global network of souls and hearts and efforts to really transform our world. And I know it sounds very woo-woo, and forgive me, I'm a California girl, but I definitely can feel it, especially, you know, I've done things with Eve Ensler, and I'm working now with Lama Sultram Alioni, who's a Tibetan Lama, and she's doing a program called Women Rising. And, you know, just seeing this pulse that's happening, I do believe I'll get to see, or my daughter at least will get to see change in her lifetime. So thank you, Shiza, for being a change maker. Thank you for being on the podcast. And I hope to have you back when you can talk about what you're working on. It's very intriguing. And for our listeners, where can they find you?
Well, they can find me on Twitter. The handle is @Shiza. And I'll be launching a website and a newsletter soon with more information. But thank you for having me, and thank you for all that you do for women. You're an inspiration.
It's my absolute pleasure. And for more about me, you can go to Twitter. I have a handle from my old tea days called @mistressoftea. My Facebook is /ZHENA, Zena. I am on LinkedIn, and I am also on Instagram @Zena1. And for any of you who know who took @Zena on Instagram, I've been trying to get a hold of that person because they have no posts and they hijacked my name. So I would love to have @Zena, but for now I have @Zena1. Contact me there and let's carry on the conversation.